Welcome to this episode of Stories from General Conference about serving in the church through callings, Volume 2. The pioneers were asked to sacrifice a lot in order to fulfill a prophet's call to settle in the Salt Lake Valley. President Gordon B. Hinckley talked about their diligence in the October 1989 Sunday morning session.
For a moment, may I take you back 142 years when there was, of course, no tabernacle here, nor temple, nor temple square. On July 24, 1847, the pioneer company of our people came into this valley. An advance group had arrived a day or two earlier. Brigham Young arrived on Saturday. The next day, Sabbath services were held, both in the morning and in the afternoon. There was no hall of any kind in which to meet. I suppose that in the blistering heat of that July Sunday, they sat on the tongues of their wagons and leaned against the wheels while the brethren spoke. The season was late, and they were faced with a gargantuan and immediate task if they were to grow seed for the next season. But President Young pleaded with them not to violate the Sabbath then or in the future. The next morning, they divided into groups to explore their surroundings. Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, and a handful of their associates hiked from their campground a little to the south of us, on past the ground where we are, and up the hill to a north of us. They climbed a dome-shaped peak, President Young having difficulty because of his recent illness. When the brethren stood on the summit, they looked over this valley to the south of them. It was largely barren except for the willows and rushes that grew along the streams that carried water from the mountains to the lake. There was no building of any kind, but Brigham Young had said the previous Saturday, "This is the place." The summit where they stood was named Ensign Peak, out of reference to these great prophetic words of Isaiah. "And he, speaking of God, will lift up an ensign to the nations from far, and will hiss unto them from the end of the earth. And behold, they shall come with speed swiftly. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." There is some evidence to indicate that Wilford Woodruff took from his pocket a bandana handkerchief and waved it as an ensign or a standard to the nations, that from this place should go forth the word of the Lord, and to this place should come the people of the earth. I think they may also on that occasion have spoken of the building of the temple, which today stands a few feet east of here, in fulfillment of the words of Isaiah. "And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." How foolish, someone might have said, had he heard these men that July morning of 1847. They did not look like statesmen with great dreams. They did not look like rulers poring over maps and planning an empire. These were exiles driven from their fair city on the Mississippi into this desert region of the West. But they were possessed of a vision drawn from the scriptures and words of Revelation. I marvel at the foresight of that little group. It was both audacious and bold. It was almost unbelievable. Here they were, almost 1,000 miles from the nearest settlement to the east, and almost 800 miles from the Pacific coast. They were in an untried climate. The soil was different from that of the black loam of Illinois and Iowa, where they had most recently lived. They had never raised a crop here. They had never experienced a winter. They had not built a structure of any kind. These prophets, dressed in old travel-worn clothes, standing in boots they had worn for more than 1,000 miles from Nauvoo to this valley, spoke of a millennial vision. They spoke out of a prophetic view of the marvelous destiny of this cause. They came down from the peak that day and went to work to bring reality to their dream. Sometimes in our day, as we walk our narrow paths and fill our little niches of responsibility, we lose sight of the grand picture. When I was a small boy, draft horses were common. An important part of the harness was the bridle. On the bridle were blinders, one on each side. They were so placed that the horse could see only straight ahead and not to either side. They were designed to keep him from becoming frightened or distracted, and to keep his attention on the road at his feet. Some of us do our work as if we had blinders on our eyes. We only see our own little narrow track. We catch nothing of the broader vision. Ours may be a small responsibility in the church. It is good to fulfill that responsibility with diligence, and it is also good to know how that responsibility contributes to the great overall program of the growing kingdom of God.
Missionaries are like the pioneers in that they're also called to move to a foreign land to establish the Lord's kingdom all around the world. But whether you're a full-time missionary or not, Elder Russell M. Ballard said that all members of the church, wherever they are, have the duty to welcome new members. This talk is from October 1988 General Conference.
Brothers and sisters, we must ever keep in mind that missionary work throughout the world requires great sacrifice, and all of this sacrifice, effort, and exhaustive preparation of missionaries may be in vain if those who accept the gospel do not receive a loving and warm welcome by members of the church. We know from years of experience that the first contacts new converts have with members in wards or branches are critical to the conversion process. Recently, several of the brethren were discussing how we accept and welcome newcomers. Two of them shared experiences with me. Elder DeVere Harris of the First Carm of the 70 told me of a recent visit he made to a long-established ward in Utah. He said, quote, "I entered there as a stranger and tried every way that I knew to strike up a conversation or to say hello or to be kind or to be greeted or to be known. Everyone ignored me. Nobody would speak to me. No one. Finally, a man recognized me. He said, 'Oh, Elder Harris.' And the bishop turned around and said, 'What did you say?' The brother said, 'This is Elder Harris of the First Carm of the 70. Well, things changed. It wasn't long before I was asked to sit on the stand. They wondered if I wouldn't like to bear my testimony. After the meeting, many people shook my hand. As I left, I thought, what a tragedy. A gray-haired man who was unknown walks into a meeting. Nobody recognizes him. Nobody says hello. Nobody is kind. Then, because of his church position, everybody changed and wanted to be friendly." The second story involves two sisters who lived 2,000 miles from each other. Each was taught the missionary discussions by the full-time missionaries. Each felt the confirming witness of the Spirit and was baptized. Both were single adults in their early 20s. One sister attended church meetings, met the bishop, developed friendships with members who invited her into their homes. Ward members made her feel welcome and wanted. She was given a church calling immediately after her baptism, and she continued to learn and live gospel principles while associating with ward and stake members. She participated continuously, serving in various ward, stake, and general church callings. In time, she married in the temple and maintains her standing as a full membership in the church. The other sister, after receiving the witness of the Spirit, never met her bishop personally. She received no visits by home teachers or visiting teachers and was given no church calling. For several weeks, she attended Sunday ward meetings, but she was mostly ignored. In due course, the missionaries who had taught her left the area, and her interest waned in the gospel without the support of members. She was not remembered and nourished. Soon she stopped attending church services, resumed her old friendships and lifestyle, and married a non-member. Today she is a fine, productive, contributing citizen in her community and a loving, conscientious wife and mother, but she does not enjoy the rich blessings that come from full fellowship in the church. In contrast to these two experiences, the church news featured two older sister missionaries who exemplify the attributes of love and caring for those while serving on their missions in Duchesne, Utah. The stake president credited these sisters with bringing a spirit of warmth and friendship to his stake. In fact, the teaching and fellowshipping efforts of these sisters has helped change the attitude of the whole stake. The work of the Lord is more effectively coming together and influencing everyone, including the less active as well as the non-members. The stake president said that in small farming communities, the activation of a less active family has a big effect on others. He expects 12 to 15 families to become active and go through the temple this year.
Callings aren't just about strengthening others. Sometimes they're about strengthening yourself. President Thomas S. Monson shared a story about an old stake president who said he actually benefited from his years of service. This was in the October 1989 priesthood session.
Many years ago, I was assigned to divide the Modesto, California stake. The Saturday meetings had been held, the new stake presidency selected, and preparations concluded for the activities of the next morning, the Sunday session of conference. As the Sunday session was about to begin, there went through my mind the thought that I had been in Modesto before. But when? I let my mind search back through the years for a confirmation of the thought I was thinking. Suddenly I remembered, Modesto years ago had been a part of the San Joaquin stake which I attended. The stake president was Clifton Rooker. He lived in Modesto. I had stayed in his home during that conference. Oh, but that was many years earlier. Could my thoughts be playing tricks on me this morning? I said to the stake president and his counselors as they sat on the stand, is this the same stake which Clifton Rooker once presided over? The brethren answered, yes, it is. He was our former president. It's been many years since I was last here, I said. Is Brother Rooker still here? Is he with us today? They responded, oh, yes. We saw him early this morning as he came to conference. I asked, where is he seated on this day of special historic importance when the stake will be divided? We don't know exactly, they said. The response was a good one, for the building was filled to overflowing. I stepped to the pulpit and asked, is Clifton Rooker in the audience today? There he was, way back in the recreation hall, hardly in view of the pulpit. I felt the inspiration to say to him publicly, Brother Rooker, we have a place for you on the stand. Would you please come forward? With every eye watching, Clifton Rooker made that long walk from the rear of the building right up to the front and took his place by my side. It became my opportunity to call upon him, one of the pioneers of that stake, to bear his testimony and to tell the people whom he loved that he was the actual beneficiary of the service he had rendered to his Heavenly Father and to his stake members. After the session was concluded, I said, Brother Rooker, how would you like to step into the Relief Society room with me and help me set apart the two new stake presidencies of these stakes? He replied, "Brother Monson, that would be a highlight for me." We proceeded to the Relief Society room, and there with his hands joining mine and the hands of the outgoing stake presidency, we set apart those two new stake presidencies to their calling. After that, Brother Rooker and I embraced as he said goodbye and went to his home that Sunday evening. Early the next morning, after I had returned to my home, I had a telephone call from the son of Clifton Rooker. "Brother Monson," he said, "I'd like to tell you about my dad. He passed away this morning, but before he did so, he said that yesterday was truly the happiest day of his life." As I heard that message from Brother Rooker's son, I paused to thank God for the inspiration which came to me to invite this good man while he was yet alive and able to enjoy them to come forward and receive the plaudits of the stake members whom he had served.
Bishops and stake presidents sacrifice a lot to serve members in their wards and branches. We need to support them in their callings. Also in the October 1989 priesthood session, Elder Joe J. Christensen shared appreciation for the priesthood leaders who blessed his life.
"When I was a young man, about the age of some of you deacons here, my dad was bishop of the ward of our little farming town of Benida in southeastern Idaho. I remember the first time he brought me with him to Salt Lake City to attend a general priesthood meeting. In those years, Dad always seemed to me to be really old. As I recognize now, he must have been around 38 years of age. I was happy to be with him. I remember we sat in the balcony there on the north side. Before the meeting started, Dad pointed out which one of the brethren on the stand was President Heber J. Grant and which were his counselors. I saw the 12 apostles and the other brethren. And that night, a warm feeling of love and respect for the leaders of the church came over me and has continued to grow to this day. That night, I decided I wanted to do everything I could to support my dad as bishop. I didn't want to do anything that would embarrass or disappoint him. To this day, I'm grateful for those feelings that came to me that night."
You're listening to the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Today, we're listening to stories about receiving callings in the church. If you're a priesthood holder, the best way to honor the priesthood is to serve. Elder Glenn L. Rudd explained it in the April 1988 Saturday afternoon session.
"When I was a young man in the Aaronic priesthood, we boys used to stand in our core meeting and repeat in unison, 'Priesthood means service. Bearing the priesthood, I will serve.' This was our weekly pledge. It was part of every core meeting. Most of us began to understand that honoring the priesthood required our being active and serving in the church. In those days, we played a lot of tennis. We knew that in tennis, if we didn't serve well, we didn't win. Our priesthood leaders taught us the same concept insofar as the church was concerned. They helped us to learn to serve at the proper time and in the proper way. No boy or man fully possesses the priesthood until he learns to serve others and the Lord. It is true that someone with authority may bestow the priesthood by the laying on of hands, but until we do something by way of service to others, the priesthood lies dormant within us and is of little value. We must not fail to magnify the callings we receive."
You never know. The things you're called to do now could be preparing you for something greater. Elder Lynn A. Sorensen talked about how receiving a testimony as a young boy prepared him for the many callings he would have throughout life. This was in the October 1987 Sunday afternoon session.
"I can remember, as if it were yesterday, the first time that I attended General Conference. I was just a young boy, and my wonderful parents brought me to the tabernacle so that I could have a special spiritual experience early in my life. We sat in the balcony here at the left of the podium where I could look down directly at the general authorities. It was a great thrill for me to see President Heber J. Grant for the first time. And I particularly remember how President Grant joined in the congregational singing with such fervor, and how uncomfortable the hard wooden benches seemed to me, even at that young age. I remember looking at the upholstered individual seats occupied by the Tabernacle Choir and deciding that someday I would sing in the choir and have a comfortable reserved seat for conference. Well, somehow the lines of communication got mixed up. This was not what I had in mind at all. I'm grateful for my assignment in the Brazil Area Presidency with Elder Gibbons and Elder Camargo, and the opportunity to serve once again with the warm, wonderful people of Brazil. I've been especially blessed in being involved in various ways in the growth of the church there over the last 48 years, and have seen that growth go from less than 200 members in 1940 to over 250,000 members today. As we attend the various state conferences, it is thrilling to meet the young leaders whom the Lord has raised up. Men such as President Santos. He embraced the gospel as a young boy of 17. And when he elected to accept a missionary call, he was disowned by his family and put out on the street with his meager belongings. He served faithfully, however, and later was led to a beautiful young convert girl. They were sealed in the temple and are rearing their family under the covenant. Still under 30 years of age, he is successful in his business and a great leader in the stake. How the Lord blesses the faithful members of the church. Sister Sorensen and I recently had the opportunity to tour the new Fortaleza mission. It took us back to our own missionary experiences. A mission president receives hundreds of weekly letters from his missionaries during his presidency concerning many different subjects. Most of those I received were very spiritual, expressing the missionaries' gratitude for the opportunity to serve the Lord and his testimony of the importance and truthfulness of the work. I've saved most of them. They are precious to me. One touched my heart profoundly. Elder Costa, a native Brazilian missionary, wrote in his last letter to me before we left the mission field, "President, perhaps with the passing of time, I will forget your appearance or how you walked or things like that. Let your love for the gospel and your testimony, I will never forget. If I'm to be remembered at all by the membership of the church, I hope it will be in this manner. For I do have a great love for the gospel and for all the members of the church everywhere. No, I do not feel at ease sitting in these red upholstered chairs, but I have a sincere burning testimony of this work. May the Lord bless me that I may touch the lives of those he loves throughout the church. And may I be guided and directed by him always."
Just as important as any leadership calling, though, is to be a home teacher. President Ezra Taft Benson gave his testimony about home teaching in the April 1987 priesthood session.
May I close by bearing you my testimony regarding home teaching. I can recall as if it were yesterday, growing up as a boy in Whitney, Idaho. We were a farm family. And when we boys were out working in the field, I remember fathers calling to us in a shrill voice from the barnyard, "Tie up your teams, boys, and come in. The ward teachers are here." Regardless of what we were doing, that was the signal to assemble in the sitting room to hear the ward teachers. These two faithful brethren, priesthood bearers, would come each month, either by foot or by horseback. We always knew they would come. I can't remember one miss. And we would have a great visit. They would stand behind a chair and talk to the family. They would go around the circle and ask each child how he or she was doing and if we were doing our duty. Sometimes mother and father would prime us before the ward teachers came so we would have the right answers. But it was an important time for us as a family. They always had a message, and it was always a good one. We have refined home teaching a lot since those early days in Whitney, but it is basically the same. The same principles are involved: caring, reaching out, teaching by the Spirit, an important message each month, a concern and loving of each member of the family.
We magnify our callings best by serving those around us. Elder J. Richard Clark shared several touching stories of such service in the April 1991 priesthood session.
Let me share some examples of the priesthood in action. An inspiring funeral was held for an 18-year-old boy we'll call John. John was a remarkable young man who courageously battled muscular dystrophy and lost. He was confined to a wheelchair during his Aaronic priesthood years. Conspicuous at the funeral were devoted members of his priest quorum. John's influence upon his quorum was profound, and yet he never played a football game, nor went camping with him, nor danced, nor did any of the usual teenage activities. It was his faith and commitment to the church that touched his quorum members. And something else, John provided his quorum with an opportunity to serve with love. When John was a deacon, he wanted to pass the sacrament. One boy was assigned to push his wheelchair while John held the tray on his lap. It seemed awkward at first, but soon others were anxious to help him perform his priesthood duty. By the time John was ordained a priest, he was very weak and could not kneel to bless the sacrament. His quorum found a solution. They placed his wheelchair next to the sacrament table. One would break the bread, then kneel by him, by the wheelchair, and hold a microphone while John pronounced those sacred words. To do this for their brothers soon became an honor for each one in the quorum. They enthusiastically followed his leadership as first assistant in the priest quorum. Because John was unable to realize his dream of becoming an Eagle Scout, the priests raised money to buy a special achievement plaque, which was given to him in sacrament meeting. It read, "Presented to John for outstanding service in your quorum and for being a great example to us all." Over the years, the young men in John's quorum enjoyed many fun activities, but none had greater impact or taught them more about magnifying their priesthood callings and loving each other than this joyous experience they shared with their friend John. Now, we expect a lot from our Aaronic priesthood brethren, and properly trained, they seldom disappoint us. I remember when Dr. Harold Hume served as a bishopric advisor to a deacon's quorum. They were invited to tour a hospital. He introduced his quorum to the nurses. One of them said, "How unusual. The deacons in our church are older men." And Dr. Hume replied, "Well, our deacons are outstanding young men. They can handle it when they're 12 years old." Remember a few years ago when devastating fires burned out of control in Southern California? As fierce winds blew, the public was restricted from the area by police. A few families were allowed to remain and try to save their homes. Soon a van arrived at one house filled with brethren from the quorum carrying their shovels. They were asked, "How did you get past the police barricade?" Response, "It was easy. We just told them our brother lives here." The count was soon up to 39 brethren who were helping to dig a ditch for fire protection. A curious police officer appeared and said, "I just want to meet the man who has 39 brothers." Elder Matthew Cowley once asked an elders' quorum president how his elders were getting along as a quorum. "You do anything to help one another?" "Oh, yes," was the response. "We've got a member of our quorum in the hospital in New Mexico. He was a vigorous young man buying a farm, a hard worker with a lovely family. All of a sudden, he was stricken. That could have meant the end of his farm and family security." The elders' quorum president said, "That was our loss as much as for his wife and children. So we took over, and we've operated that farm. And all he has to worry about is getting well." How many times we magnify our callings individually, quietly, without fanfare. I'm thinking of an elders' quorum president, Kirk Barnett, in Las Vegas. Visiting a hospital early one morning, he was impressed to ask if any other LDS were there. He was told of an elderly grandmother awaiting her first surgery for brain hemorrhage. She had no family or friends present, no one to encourage her. She was terrified. President Barnett sat with her for 2 hours. His hand was white from her strong grip. She said she loved him at least 20 times.
Even though what we're asked to do may not seem to matter, we should never stop doing it. As you'll see in this next example from President Thomas S. Monson, your labor is never in vain. This is from the April 1986 priesthood session.
The call of duty came to me to serve as a young bishop back in 1950. I studied diligently the scriptures. I particularly liked reading the Apostle Paul's epistle to Timothy on what the requirements of a bishop were. I even read the general handbook. It was smaller then than it is now. But I think I gained the greatest help from one of the general authorities who came to a priesthood leadership meeting, stepped to a chalkboard, and outlined the duties of a bishop. I would hope, brethren, that as leaders, we would step to chalkboards and outline the duties of deacons and teachers and priests and all who hold the priesthood, the scriptures being our guide. In that outline, the first call was that the bishop is the presiding high priest and the father of the ward. Second, he is the president of the Aaronic priesthood. Third, he is responsible to care for the poor and the needy. Fourth, he is the one who receives the tithing and is responsible for the funds and likewise the records of the ward. And fifth, he is the common judge in Israel. Those outlined duties are understood. But I received a letter from church headquarters back at that time, which was a little more challenging to me. The Korean War had just burst forth, and a letter to all bishops said, each bishop is to supply each serviceman in his ward with a subscription paid in advance to the Improvement Era, to the Church News, and write a personal letter to each serviceman every month. I thought to myself, do the brethren know that I have 23 servicemen in this ward of 1,080 members? A letter every month? Do they know we have no money? Fortunately, I trusted in the Lord. The money came from the high priests in the 70s. The subscriptions were arranged. But writing that personal letter to 23 servicemen every month did not really become a drudgery. It became a joy and a blessing for me. I still have some of the copies of those letters and the responses which came from them. I still get a little teary-eyed when I read of a soldier's pledge to do his duty, a sailor's determination to keep faith with his family. One night, as I had completed writing the 23 letters, I handed them to the young lady who would affix the postage stamps and handle the maintenance of the addresses. She turned to me as she looked at one envelope and said, "Bishop, don't you ever get discouraged?" I said, "No, I don't. Why?" She said, "Here is another letter to Thaddeus Bryson, Jr. This is the 17th consecutive monthly letter that you've sent to him without a reply." I said, "Well, send it along. Maybe it will work." And it did. I received a reply to that letter. I have it here with me tonight, dated December 25th, 1953. It was postmarked APO San Francisco. He was serving on a remote island in the Pacific. Christmas, homesick, missing family and friends. He had been among the less active when he went in the service. But he began his letter this way: "Dear Bishop, I ain't much at writing letters. I could have told him that 17 months sooner." But he went on to say that he appreciated the magazines, the newspaper, that he had been ordained a priest by his servicemen's coordinator. And then he said, "Most of all, I appreciate your letters." I thought of the couplet, "Do your duty, that is best, leave unto the Lord the rest." Years later, I was attending a conference at the Cottonwood Stake in Salt Lake City when Elder James Faust was presiding there. The theme was taking care of our servicemen. The Vietnam War was in full bloom. I spoke of this experience, and after the meeting, a young man came forward and said, "Bishop, do you remember me?" I said, "My goodness, Brother Bryson, how are you?" "I'm fine," he said. "I'm in the Elders' Corps and presidency of my ward. And by the way, Bishop, thank you, thank you, thank you for the letters."
As President Thomas S. Monson said, "Do your duty, that is best. Leave unto the Lord the rest." We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stories from General Conference, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.